The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection. Support comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. With us is probably the most informed, most articulate person on the political scene, our Blair Horner. I'm not just telling you that. You just have to pick up the New York Times someday and there you'll see his name. He's the executive director of the New York Public Interest Research Group, or NYPIRG. Welcome back, my good friend Blair.
I wasn't quite sure who you were introducing when you started it off.
Well, I can tell you right now that we are very proud of everything you've done and the fact that you come and talk to us. Let's talk, first of all, about the governor's state of the state. What did you like? What didn't you like, Blair? What do you think?
Well, you know, I've seen a bunch of these, as have you, Alan, over the many years. And there's a certain formula as governors get, you know, reelected year after year after year. And so, you know, there is when they first start, there's the speech is often about promises and things they're going to be doing. And over time, more and more time gets spent on how great things are and how great a job they've been doing. And so in many ways, it felt like a standard State of the State address. Like his father's, there was definitely national tones you could hear, juxtaposing how Albany gets things done versus the circus down in Washington and how things can get accomplished in New York in a you know, collegial sort of way, the way he described it. One of the things that struck me was sort of the national undertone to it in terms of the contrasting and comparing how he governs versus how the president governs. There were some good things, but, you know, like in any of these State of the State addresses, they're just words right now. The words came, about an hour and 20-minute speech. It came with a 300-plus page book of proposals. You know, there's a lot of stuff to plow through, but the rubber starts to hit the road when the bills get introduced because, you know, what really matters are the details. And as you're quite right, I was sort of, what struck me was maybe the first hour of the speech was about, much of it was about spending, more spending on programs. And really, how do you square that with a $6 billion deficit at the same time? I think, again, he didn't say how he was going to do that, and yet that's the big gorilla in the room.
Well, you know, Blair Horner, we've got a Democratic governor and two Democratic houses. I've always believed that this governor wanted, like his father wanted, in my opinion, to have the Republicans in power in the Senate so they could put a brake on the spending that Assembly Democrats and others would want to do. What do you make of that?
That's probably true. I mean, that's certainly the way that everybody viewed the world when Governor Mario Cuomo was in, even in the beginning of the Governor Andrew Cuomo terms. What's different now is this Governor Cuomo has far more firepower when it comes to controlling the state budget than his father did. His father had the same, as it turned out, the same legal authority to make it very difficult for the legislature to change the budget. He just didn't know it. It really wasn't really until the end of the Pataki administration and then in particular Governor Patterson that there was this legal interpretation that it's very hard for the legislature to cover to change the governor's budget without voting it down. And both houses of the legislature being Democratic, the governor still has the upper hand until the Senate Democrats have a supermajority, which may occur this year. That could change the political dynamic if they
just
could.
Just for everybody, Blair, tell everybody what a supermajority is.
Well, the way I'm interpreting it right now is that they would have enough votes to override a governor's veto. And the Assembly Democrats have that now. And again, that doesn't necessarily mean they would do it, but it gives them a much stronger hand vis-a-vis the governor if both houses can override the governor's veto with their own political party. The Democrats would need to pick up a net gain, I think, of 2 seats in next year's election in order to have that. But right now, for this budget, they don't. And so the governor's ability to strong arm them in the budget process is far greater than his father's.
You use the word strong arm, and I certainly subscribe to that. I think that's correct. Would you really want to start a fight with this particular governor? I mean, this is a guy who doesn't take prisoners, that's for sure.
Well, in a political sense, that's right. And it's an election year, and the legislature's up, the governor's not up. It's an election year, they're facing a $6 billion budget deficit. They're going to want to do everything they can to make that as painless as possible and as politically popular as possible. And so what we've seen in recent years, one of the reasons why the budget got so big is they sort of kicked the can on some of the expenses, particularly Medicaid, forward each fiscal year, and it accumulates. And now it's $4 billion, roughly $4 billion of the $6 billion deficit. And so, you know, this year, they really need to work together in order to not end up with a political food fight, which could hurt candidates running in November.
Okay, so on the Medicaid thing, this is very interesting. Now, remember, everybody, that Medicaid is for the elderly and the poor, basically, and it is a program that has been very expansive in New York State. And you talked about food fight. The ultimate food fight in New York State and New York City has been the governor versus the mayor.
That's right.
So he lobs one in his speech and he says, we're giving you guys too much money. We can't give you this much money down in New York City. Well, everybody says their hair goes up on the top of their heads and they say, that's not fair.
And this is an annual thing between this governor and this mayor. And to some extent, the city ends up picking up some of the tab that the governor shoves their way. Part of the analysis, such that it is that New York City is sort of reasonably well financially reserved because they have a different system down there in terms of the way they keep the books. You can't play the games of moving money around from here to there or kicking the can forward. They have to, because of the fiscal crisis in the 1970s, they have to have good fiscal accounting and very strong fiscal controls, which the state does not have. And so the city's flush, the state's broke, or at least in a deficit. So the governor is looking, one of the painless ways to deal with that is to shift some of the deficit from the state to localities, and New York City is the biggest locality. So it's an annual sort of fight between the mayor and the governor, and it wouldn't surprise me if some of those costs end up getting shifted to the city of New York.
It's hard to believe that he's going to come up with $6 billion in savings, on this thing.
I agree.
He's got to find some money somewhere, and I don't know where that somewhere is. Of course, he went out of his way in the speech to talk about how he's been cutting taxes, not raising taxes. But, there's very few ways you can get that extra money you're going to need, except with so-called revenue enhancers.
That's right. And, the way his father has did it and the way other governors have done it and the way that this governor will probably do it, there are ways to raise revenues without raising people's tax rates. I mean, yesterday, in fact, the governor talked about cutting taxes again.
He did.
For the middle class. And I'm not exactly sure how you square that with a $6 billion budget deficit. So unless you do some sort of creative fiscal accounting or you raise the money somewhere else or the tax cut doesn't go into effect. I mean, there are ways to change the state's tax code where there are all these benefits built in because powerful groups have lobbied for them. And to some extent, the state piggybacks its tax code on the federal tax code. And so you have things like business expenses for the fossil fuel industry, for their mining activities that may make sense. I don't think so, but may make sense nationally, doesn't in New York. So there may be ways you could look at modernizing the corporate tax code in a way you could pick up some new revenues. But they're going to have to come up with some new revenues as a way to deal with it. They're not going to cut their way out of this.
Well, Blair Horner, I have a question for you. You are, of course, are the head of NYPIRG. NYPIRG has a lot of young people in it, a lot of students. The governor went out of his way to talk about expanding his free tuition program. There are people who have said what sounded like a great program in the beginning was a little bit phony in that a lot of people got cut out of being able to use it. And this is a year he doesn't have a lot of money to spend. What's that all about?
Yeah, I mean, there's something called the Excelsior Scholarship Program, which for public college students is that if your family income is up to $125,000, you are eligible for additional financial aid beyond the TAP program, Tuition Assistance Program, to cover the cost of tuition. Now, in the SUNY system, for example, tuition is about $7,000. Fees on top of that can vary from anywhere from $1,000 to $3,000 more. That's not covered by the Excelsior Scholarship Program. And the way that it's since they call it a scholarship, it's not an entitlement program, so that comes with lots of strings attached. And one of the big strings is you have to hit a certain number of credits in a certain period of time, 30 credits in a year. And if you don't, and if you got the scholarship and you don't, your scholarship turns into a loan that you have to pay back. And so the beneficiary is a relatively small number. There's 800,000-900,000 public college students in the state. About 30,000 of them get the Excelsior Scholarship Program. Yesterday, the governor showed a slide which showed a lot more students benefiting, but that's mainly because more people got TAP coverage. The Excelsior Scholarship Program is fairly contained. Now, that being said, for those families, it's good news. No doubt about it, right? They don't have to pony up the money that they might have had to have done. But I mean, our point of view would be if you're going to spend all that money, dump it into the TAP program. It's an entitlement program. It helps the students that really need it.
Remind everybody what TAP is.
It's a tuition assistance program. It's for public and private colleges. It covers tuition up to $5,165 a year, which is less than public college tuition, far less than private college tuition. But it helps. And you get it just based on income. There's no strings attached. End of story. You make under a certain amount, particularly if you're low income, it covers the whole freight of going to college, because even that difference between the $5,000 and the $7,000, if you're poor, the colleges have to cover the cost for the tuition, public colleges.
Well, Blair, I noticed that one of the things he wanted to do with his program is to raise the amount of money that the parents could make.
Up to $150,000.
Now, what's that all about?
Well, it's going to mean that more families will benefit from higher
income.
Yeah, but
why? I mean, he's obviously got a political reason for doing that.
Well, look, again, for the families that benefit, it's good news.
Yeah.
It is also a way to talk about free tuition and to sort of contrast what New York is doing with the rest of the country.
Now, TAP, let me get this straight. TAP basically helps people with very low incomes.
Well, it's sliding scale up to about $80,000 family income.
Right.
But the big bulk, the benefits really are for the poorest college students.
So he's reaching out.
So he's adding middle class families from roughly 80,000 to now, if he gets his proposal through, up to 150,000. But again, it's going to cost more money, even if it is only, let's say, 10,000 more families or students. It's going to add more cost to the state when the state's running a $6 billion deficit. Again, you could argue that the TAP program makes tuition free too, right? Because for the students at the lowest income level, their tuition's covered. But it's a different way of looking at it, and it's a way to have significant cost controls on it, because as a lot fewer students benefit from it than the tuition assistance program, which is hundreds of thousands of students benefit from that.
So when I was listening to this speech yesterday, I was driving the car, I'll admit it, and I almost drove off the road.
Because this is why you're not supposed to listen to it when you're driving.
Because I thought I heard Franklin Delano Roosevelt preparing to be president of the United States. I saw a sort of similarity.
Well, the car showed up.
In the rhetoric, yeah.
He talked about FDR's car and, of course, had a picture of him driving it over the new Mario Cuomo Bridge, a.k.a. the Tappan Zee Bridge.
Could he win? Could Andrew Cuomo, with that Queens accent, he's pretty effective.
Yes.
Could he be the presidential candidate, not this round, but assuming there's a loss by the Democrats this time, the next time?
Well, every governor of the state of New York is considered presidential timber. It's a big state. It includes the media capital and financial capital of the world. Every governor, certainly in their own minds, considers themselves presidential timber. And you would have to think, I mean, there's never been an Italian-American elected president, even though Delano was the middle name of Franklin Roosevelt. And, you know, he's accomplished a lot. I mean, what he talked about yesterday to get that, you know, progressive, pragmatic progressivism is really getting things done. It's not just talking about it. It's a sort of a backhanded way to slap down more liberal members of the Democratic Party. But it's also true. I mean, he does get a lot of things done. And so if the president gets reelected and if the circus continues for another term, the public may be willing to look for somebody who's as hard-nosed as the president, but who can deliver and, you know, runs a modicum of rational government. They might be looking for that. Now, they might be looking for it this fall, too. But assuming that the president gets reelected, you would have to think the governor would be among the tier of candidates that would be considered coming up in 2024.
I agree with you. I think you're right on target on that, as usual.
The thing, though, is he's not getting any younger. And, you know, he's in his early 60s now. 4 years from now, he'll be pushing 70. And one of the things that might be, you know, the country wants to have somebody very different from who the incumbent is, generally speaking. And so the country may be looking for someone younger, and that might be a problem for him going forward.
Well, he can't get younger.
That's absolutely true. But you can pick somebody younger.
Blair Horner, let's talk a little bit about criminal justice reforms. And the big kahuna among them is the idea about bail. Right now, nonviolent crime becomes a potential to let somebody out with no bail. The definition of nonviolent crime, to me, is somewhat elusive.
Well,
I mean, a woman goes up to two Jewish women and slaps them in the face. That ain't violent crime.
It's pretty violent to me, yeah. Particularly if you're the person on the receiving end of the slap.
And gets out free and goes and does it another time. So it's incredible.
Yeah, and you know, there are certain kinds of reforms where the public is going to want it, and they're going to be happy with it, and it's hard to see the potential pitfalls down the road. In this case, you sort of can see it. I mean, the argument is that if you're financially well off, bail's not a big deal. So you're off the hook. You slap two people in the face. You have the money to do it. You're off. You don't have to post bail, but you still have to face justice. If you're poor, you know, you get locked up. And there were these horror stories of people getting locked up and not being able to even get out because they couldn't post bail to get out of prison, out of jail, and they were in there for years. But going forward, when you do the reform, it's easy to write the stories about the person who slips through the cracks, who does turn out to be a dangerous person. It's hard to write the story about the person who doesn't go to jail because you don't know what doesn't happen, right? It's hard to talk about something that doesn't happen. It's easy to talk about someone who slips through the cracks. And you could see that that was going to be a problem going forward. You could see from a public relations perspective that it's an easy story to write because someone will slip through the cracks. Just like prior to the law, people slip through the cracks because they couldn't afford bail and they're in jail for the longest time. And they became the poster stories for the need for reform. And so how do you harmonize those two things? Who knows? But it's become a politically charged issue, and it's an election year. And so I think the legislature and the governor are going to want to do something about it. Not clear what, but they'll want to do something about it prior to November.
So Leader Kolb is out.
Right.
He's a Republican. I liked him. He sat where you're sitting many times. We've had conversations.
Yeah, he's a straight-up guy.
He did what so many people do. He just messed up.
Yes.
He wrote a column, and he said, don't drink and drive. And then he drunk, and he drived.
And a state car, which makes it even worse,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Look, we all make mistakes. And, you know, I grew up in the 60s and 70s. I'm sure there's lots of mistakes that if I thought about it enough, I wouldn't want it to be spilling out. But drinking and driving is a bad one. Luckily, in this case, nobody got hurt. And the fact that he was driving around in a state car, there's clearly no state business happening, raises the second issue.
Don't they all get cars, the leaders? Don't they?
Yeah, there's a relatively small number of legislators that get cars, and there are members of the executive branch that get driven around in cars, too. I mean, it's sort of a perk of the job. Now, you can make a pretty good case, why should they have cars? They're part-time. Why should they have state cars to drive around in? And I think that's a legitimate question for them to be able to tell the public why it's so important for them to have state cars to drive around. Certainly, they should not be driving around for private matters in state cars. I think everyone would agree on that. And so they have an honor system, it seems like, with the cars. Kolb's story is twofold. One is human error. The state car issue is sort of related, obviously, but it does raise the issue of the perks of the job. They all just got gigantic pay raises. Why should they have cars? Now, if they can make the case, security issues, whatever it is, make the case. But it shouldn't just be a perk.
The Republicans, as you have suggested, in the state assembly are an endangered species. So this became an interesting story.
Oh, yeah.
But so what?
Well, you know, so what? It's what for Kolb, right? He's not the leader anymore, and he's not going to have a car to drive in around in anymore. He's going to face the music in the justice system.
Yeah, but this is not something that is going to change the No. Change the way in which Democrats and Republicans inhabit their chamber, right?
No, no. The Assembly Republicans are, you know, at least for the foreseeable future, a minority party in the Assembly.
So, which reminds me to ask you, there do seem to be a lot of Republican state senators who, now that they have lost their chamber and their power, are bailing. It could be that they're just older now, but it's also that we don't want to be treated the same bad way by the Democrats that they treated us.
Right. It's that. Look, there's nothing like being in power and controlling the flow of legislation, and your ideas become policy of the state of New York. That's great.
And if you're the chairman of the banking committee or this or that, certain things flow your way.
Yes, yes. Your financial advice, your political career can be enhanced. In the minority, it's not the same. And so now they've lost that. And I think what you've seen with the retirements, and Ken LaValle just is saying he's not going to run, and he's been the longtime chair of the Higher Education Committee. Very solid, the kind of elected official you like to see in office, somebody who takes the job seriously, is because I think they see the handwriting on the wall. The money, the campaign contributions, are going to the Democrats. They're not going to the Republicans. It's like a tenth. This is the last time I saw a report on this. About a tenth of what they used to get. And so the fact that they see that the political elite has made a judgment, and the judgment is they're not taking the House back, you know, how long do you want to stay in the minority? And so a lot of the lawmakers that have been in power for a while and chaired committees, guys like Joe Robach, for example, have chaired committees for a long time. Senator Razenhofer has been chairing. He's been a law firm. You know, you have to put up with the, you know, driving to Albany, having the, you know, your constituents.
Oh, it's really tough to go up there one or two days a week. Yeah, right.
Well, there's that. And, you know, you have to, you know, constituents complaining about the sewers, all of those things. It's like, well, what the heck? If I'm not going to get any of the benefits other than the salary and hanging out in Albany, if I'm not going to get that anymore, why be there? And I think that's what you're starting to see. And it's entirely possible. Again, you never know what's going to happen in politics. But the Democrats have a 40-seat majority now in the Senate. And that's the biggest legislative majority in decades.
Well, let's get that straight. 40-seat majority, that doesn't mean
you're right. They have 40 of 63 state Senate seats.
Right.
They're 2 seats short of a veto-proof majority. And it's real. I mean, you never know. But the president's enormously unpopular. If he's at the top of the ticket come November, it's hard to see how the Republicans can take the Senate back. And I think the recognition of that is the fact that so many of them are packing it in.
Are bailing, yep. Okay, so let's talk a little about the Working Families Party. Nothing gets me more angry than what we see here. This governor, in a fit of Cuomo-esque temper, went after these guys and apparently has succeeded, right? You want to explain what happened
here? Yeah, the legislature last budget created a commission to create a system of public financing in New York, a voluntary system of public financing where if you ran for office, every small donation dollar you raised was matched in some ratio. New York City has this for decades. Instead of doing that, although they sort of did that, but in sort of a clumsy, untested way, it really became a vehicle to punish the minor parties, including the Working Families Party.
Well, especially the Working Families
Party. Well, I mean, you know, that was certainly the reported logic, and the people that took the fight to the commission was the Working Families Party. However, it does affect the Conservative Party. It does affect what they came up with. It affects all the minor parties. And what they've done is they've changed the rules for how the minor parties operate. In order to get on the ballot, you're going to need to have a lot more signatures for petitions in order to get automatically on the ballot, which is important if you're a minor party instead of having to petition on. If you're automatically on the ballot right now, you need to have received 50,000 votes in a gubernatorial election. It's now changed to around 130,000 in both a gubernatorial election and the presidential election. And so these new obstacles will make it harder for minor parties to operate in the state of New York. The Greens are going to be affected by this in an adverse way, be my guess. The Working Families Party is going to be affected in an adverse way. Now, that being said, most of the country operates on some version of what I just described. So how that all plays out, I mean, you know, we'll see. But it's entirely likely to be the case that a lot of these minor parties are going to go bye-bye. and it'll be very hard to create the Reform Party of the future or the tax-cutting party of the future to get on the lines because they've made it a lot more difficult. Effectively, the major political parties colluded through the commission to, you know, stick it to the minor parties, and that's what they've done, and it's now the law of the land for this election.
That's disgusting. Now, let's talk about early voting. How's that working out?
Well, you know, 2019 was the first year they did it. It was a way to sort of kick the tires, test drive the idea. Basically, early voting is you can vote for some period of time prior to the general election day. The vast majority of the states have it. New York has it now, too. There's ways you could make it better in New York, no doubt about it.
How?
Well, they left a lot of the decisions up to the localities to figure out. So, for example, in the county of Rensselaer, there were no early voting polling places within the boundaries of the city of Troy. A lot of people live in Troy. Well, why would you do that? Well, good question.
You don't want them to vote.
Yeah, that's the way it works out. And so the idea of and there'll be legislation the Senate's going to be taking up actually today. They're going to be discussing it. They'll be discussing it over the session. How do you tinker with early voting to make it so that there are more polling places available and there are more polling places available on mass transit lines so that poor people can make it who may not have cars? The other big issue that came up was that K-12 schools didn't want to be early voting sites anymore because you have adults wandering around during the school day for a week. It's 9 days now is early voting. And so I think you're going to look, that's going to be an issue that's going
to
come up.
How to do that? Firehouses?
Well, the colleges would be great.
Yeah.
Right? You got a bunch of adults already walking around, and a lot of them already don't vote.
And you want college campuses to be voting places.
Yes, we do, because that makes perfect sense to us. It's a twofer. There's hundreds of them. And 18 to 24-year-olds are the people least likely to vote. You want to make it easy for them. What could be easier than having an early voting polling place in the student union for a week to get young people engaged in the political and civic process? So, we'd like to see that. But there's other things you can do to expand it instead of using K-12 sites.
It's always wonderful to have our great Blair Horner with us, who knows more about this stuff than anybody that I know. Hey, Blair, you're a courageous and great guy, and we so thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.